Well, good morning. I invite you to be opening your Bibles this morning. Book of Proverbs, chapter 8. Book of Proverbs 8. And we're going to pick up there in just a minute to get us started this morning. Book of Proverbs, chapter 8. And while you're getting settled in, finding Proverbs 8 in your Bibles, I'll extend a continued greeting to you this morning. Glad that you are here. Good to see so many visitors among us. We do have a goodly number of visitors with us today. And we're thankful that you're worshiping God here and with us. And we do hope that, especially if you're from the community and have the opportunity to stay around, and get to know us a little bit better. Let us know if we can build a longer-term relationship with you and help you find God's will for your life. We'd like to do that. And if you haven't already filled out a visitor's card, you can do that with one of the packets that's available at all three doors of the auditorium. Leave that card behind. We'll be happy to get something set up with you, but we're glad that you are here this morning. Well, this weekend was teen weekend here for the Kleinwood congregation. And so we have Friday night and all day yesterday, and into a little bit this morning in the Bible class hour. We've been working with our young people over this year's theme, The Road Less Traveled, Proverbs Two Paths, and talking with our young people about the Bible's wisdom insight that really life is about choices. And generally there's kind of two choices, right and wrong, wise and foolish. And a lot of those choices manifest themselves throughout life in various decisions that we make about our character, about truth and falsehood, about pride and humility, about anger and peace, about greed and generosity. All these different angles and aspects and avenues of life that we have to make decisions about and decisions in, two paths, two options that lay before us. And we have to make the right choice, the wise choice, the godly choice. And so we've been working that this weekend. Joining Brent and Daniel and myself was Russ Bowman in that effort. Russ had to be back where he normally preaches at the Northwest Congregation in Beaumont today. Couldn't be with us today. So, but we regret that, but glad that he was with us Friday and Saturday and working with our young people. But kind of as a capstone and to kind of wind down teen weekend this year, I want to talk a little bit this morning about this concept of two paths that really kind of go back to two trees back in the garden, back at the beginning of the human race and the human story. But to get us going this morning, we want to start reading of all places in Proverbs chapter 8. Have a Bible? Read along with me. Proverbs chapter 8, beginning of verse 1. Does not wisdom call? Does not understanding raise her voice? On the heights beside the way, at the crossroads, she takes her stand. Beside the gates in front of the town, at the entrance of the portal, she cries aloud. To you, O men, I call, and my cry is to the children of man. O simple ones, learn prudence. O fools, learn sense. Hear, for I will speak noble things, and from my lips will come what is right. For my mouth will utter truth. Wickedness is an abomination to my lips. All the words of my mouth are righteous. There is nothing twisted or crooked in them. They are all straight to him who understands and right to those who find knowledge. Take my instruction instead of silver and knowledge rather than choice gold. For wisdom is better than jewels, and all that you may desire cannot compare with her. I, wisdom, dwell with prudence. I find knowledge and discretion. The fear of the Lord is hatred of evil. Pride and arrogance in the way of evil and perverted speech I hate. I have counsel and sound wisdom. I have insight. I have strength. By me kings reign and rulers decree what is just. By me princes rule and nobles, all who govern justly. I love those who love me, and those who seek me diligently will find me. Riches and honor are with me, enduring wealth and righteousness. My fruit is better than gold, even fine gold. My yield than choice silver. I walk in the way of righteousness, in the paths of justice, granting an inheritance to those who love me and filling their treasuries. Start this morning by just simply reminding you that our time is really no different than any other age in human history where the world desperately needs wisdom. But the problem is always the same. Knowledge of the world is divorced from wisdom and how to rightly use and rightly enjoy the world. As I was telling the high school and junior high class this morning, in a lot of ways, creation is kind of like an object you buy that's got a warranty on it. You ever read the warranty paper? Ever read the warranty paper on an item you buy? Warranty, people think, in fact, it's funny, some of the young people said, well, the warranty is there for if you break something. Some of you chuckle because you've actually read the fine print on those warranties. What's the warranty there? The fine print of the warranty always is, in case of defective workmanship or the product itself is defective in the first year, it's by definition not defective in the second year. But if it's defective, then they will, of course, replace it. But most of us know, you call a manufacturer, you take your iPhone back to the Apple store, and bottom line is they're just going to help you out. They're going to give you a new one. They're not going to ask how that screen got broken. I mean, it's obviously workmanship defection there. Screen broken, whatever it is. Now, but the reality is when you keep reading the fine print on most warranty sheets, here's what you'll find. It'll also basically say if you use this product inconsistent with its intended purpose, what happens to the warranty? It's voided. It's no more. And that's basically how life is, ladies and gentlemen. God, the book of Proverbs says earlier in chapter 3 that God built the world according to wisdom. And you know what happens with life when you don't live wisely? You void the warranty on creation. You void the warranty on life. That's not, when we use life for purposes other than what God intended, when we try to ask out of creation things that it was not meant to do and purposes it was not meant to fulfill, we break reality in a sense. We break creation. It's called the fall. It's called sin. And at that point, in a sense, all bets are off. There's no getting angry at God because life didn't deliver what I hoped or what I wanted. Because at the end of the day, ladies and gentlemen, humanity collectively and we individually, we voided the warranty on reality with who we are and what we've done and how we have lived. And so what wisdom does, wisdom comes back. And the problem now is the problem that it's always been, that too often knowledge of the world is divorced from wisdom and how to rightly use and enjoy the world. It's like T.S. Eliot said nearly a century ago, where is the wisdom we have lost in knowledge? We know more and more about less and less, the old saying goes. We know more and more, scientifically speaking, about this creation than any time in the human race's history, and yet we know less and less what life is for or what life is really about. And so the problem is always the same from age to age. People know a lot about creation, but they don't know a lot about its point, about its purpose, about how to wisely use the life that God has given us. And throughout ages, from age to age, listen, if you think it's hard to get your teenagers or your children to listen to you sometimes, listen, there's nothing new about that. It's a perennial problem of the human race. That's why in chapter 4, chapter 5 of Proverbs, the wise men have to basically say in the imperative tense, get wisdom, acquire understanding. He has to almost make the case and beg people to listen and learn and live wisely. It's always been a bit of a hard sell because wisdom ultimately involves discipline. Wisdom involves delayed gratification. Wisdom involves denying desires that are disordered. And what wisdom literature really does is the wisdom literature of the Bible literally brings a sanity to those who will embrace the wisdom that flows from a robust fear of the Lord. It brings a sanity to us. It brings a clarity of vision. It brings an understanding to us. Wisdom literally shows us how disoriented reality is, how disoriented humanity really is. In our culture, the best life, real life, is often described as personal uniqueness. In our culture, we exalt the people who are really alive, people who are really living, are those who have found ways to exalt and fully live in their unique humanity. And that's why we have advertising slogans like, your way, right away, man. If there's a slogan that can summarize our era and our time and the human propensity for foolishness in a nutshell, it's that marketing slogan, your way, right away. And so our world holds out personal uniqueness. Our world says that the wise life, the good life, is freedom from any constraint or nowadays even any fear or discomfort. We're now so concerned about being completely liberated that nobody should ever even feel awkward anymore in our time and age. Culture and the worldly wisdom says it's all about empowerment. Even though not everybody can be equally powerful, but let's not quibble about the details. Good life is about everybody being empowered. The good life, the wise life, worldly wisdom is about sexual gratification of every desire and any desire, no matter how unnatural or illicit it may truly be. In our time and place, the wise and the worldly wise life is participation in some constantly new fad. I'll tell you, it's expensive and exhausting to be cutting edge all the time. And yet there it is. course, the irony is nearly every business that taps into our cultural mantle for its marketing purposes by advertising with some sort of stress on your desire or your style, or you'll be unique if you buy our product or use our product, is part of a business plan and the marketing strategy that judges itself on only if tens of thousands or even millions get their product and exercise their uniqueness. Isn't that ironic? But at the end of the day, there's godly wisdom based in the fear of the Lord. She stands all around, but she stands among other places. Chapter 8 and verse 2, she stands at the crossroads. She stands at the place where people decide which direction they're going to go, which city they're headed to, which destiny will be theirs. She stands there. She positions herself there. And she cries out. And a lot of ways, what Proverbs chapter 8 is, in a lot of ways, is it is wisdom's resume. It is her list of what she can do and what she has done and what she can accomplish. It's her version of reality. And especially when you get to chapter 8 and verse 12. When you get to chapter 8 and verse 12, she says this. She says, I, wisdom, dwell with prudence. She dwells with prudence. Now, one of the things that happens in the wisdom literature is, as wisdom literature often calls for a choice and it points out that there are two paths, two options, two ways of doing life in general or certain aspects of life. One of the things that wisdom literature often does is it subtly often echoes Genesis. It often echoes creation images and ideology and principles that are occasionally explicitly mentioned or noticed, but more often are subtly hidden. Indeed, part of the subtle hiding of creation ideas in wisdom literature is part of the running cleverness of wisdom literature in general, that it forces you to be wise and learn to be wise, and even how you learn to read it and to read it deeply. See, ultimately, reading the wisdom literature is not just about pondering the Proverbs for their own sake, but also catching the wordplays and allusions that are there to point us to something deeper beyond what the words themselves on the surface may appear to say. And so in the wisdom literature, often, there's hiding some sort of idea connecting us back to creation, to reality as it was originally supposed to be, or how humanity has messed up reality and kept on going in that direction, calling it wisdom and good and the good life all the way. For instance, sometimes it's explicit. Back in chapter 3 of Proverbs, and beginning of verse 18, speaking of wisdom, she's a tree of life. You catch that allusion? A tree of life. What's that referring to? Wisdom, in a sense, delivers us back to the type of life that God always wanted human beings to have, where and when. Well, here, tree of life, what do you think of? Garden of Eden. That's what you think of. Wisdom is a way, it's a road, it's a path back to life as God originally intended it, and for us to enjoy the blessing that God originally intended for us to have, because the Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding, he established the heavens. And so if you live by wisdom, you're going to live by God's version and definition of reality. You're going to be following the instruction manual so you don't void the warranty on what life is and what life can be. She is a tree of life. She is the embodiment of how to live life the way God intended it to be lived back in the garden. Catch that creative and subtle illusion? Wisdom is, in a sense, then the road, the path back. It is a way of living life the way God always intended it to be. But in chapter 8 and verse 12, there's a clever little wordplay there that most translations don't know how to bring out. In chapter 8 and verse 12, where wisdom says she dwells with prudence. Wisdom dwells with prudence. It takes us back to the garden once again, where in Genesis chapter 3, many of you are well familiar with this version of the story, when mankind first falls from the garden. And the serpent was more, most translations will put something like crafty or perhaps cunning. It's the same word root that's used in Proverbs 8. Wisdom is crafty, cunning as well. She is prudent. The serpent was crafty, cunning, prudent as well. See, what happens between Proverbs 8 and Genesis 3 is prudence becomes craftiness or cunning without fear of the Lord. There's no fear of God in the satanic character. And so what happens is, and you begin to realize, we begin to see that part of what wisdom literature is trying to say is, look, I am a tree of life. I'm a way to get back to God's version of reality and living God's life God's way. I'm a way of following God's owner's manual for life and reality so that you don't void the warranty. But ultimately what happened is, once upon a time, the serpent, crafty as he was, cunning as he was, used his prudence illicitly and asked the woman to think about the tree. Is there really no tree you can eat of in the garden? And you remember the story. Eve humbly and naively corrects his misstatement. No, we can eat of any tree but one. There's one that we can't eat. Or she adds touch of it. You remember the story. Satan says, no, you're not really going to die if you eat of that forbidden tree, that tree of the knowledge of good and evil. You're not really going to die. Instead, what you're going to have is you're going to be like God. See, that's a conversation about life and death, gentlemen, isn't it? Being like God, the source of life, or avoiding death. It's a conversation about life and death at its most basic level that Eve and Satan are having there in Genesis chapter 3. You remember what happens by the time we get to verse 6. The serpent has convinced the woman, and when the woman saw that the tree was good for food, and that it was a delight to the eyes, and that the tree was to be desired, what's the next phrase? To make one wise. A different version of wisdom, to be sure. A wisdom separate from the fear of the Lord. But desired to make one wise, a different way of looking at life and looking at reality, a different way of using creation, a different way of seeing God and serving Him or not serving Him, a rival version of reality, a desire to make one wise, oh, wise, but not in the godly sense. She took his fruit, she ate, she also gave to her husband who was with her, and he ate. See, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fear of the Lord is the foundation of wisdom. When you fear God, it's prudence. When you lose the fear of the Lord, it becomes craftiness and cunning. It becomes deceitful and disoriented. And so the woman pursuing Satan's counterfeit version of wisdom comes to a crossroads, two paths, two trees. And she makes her choice. She desires a different kind of wisdom, a wisdom from below, earthly, demonic, as James will call it. In James chapter 3, James chapter 4. Ultimately, what wisdom does when she comes back to us in the pages of wisdom literature, when the tree of life gets to speak, when the tree of life gets to offer her version of wisdom, she comes back and she basically says, look, this is what wisdom is about. I'm calling you to return to a sane recognition of your proper human limits, of knowing who you are and where you're supposed to be, of wisdom through fear of the Lord, so that your cunning becomes prudence instead of the other way around. There's an interesting word, though, that's used in Genesis 3. It was desirable to make one wise. It was desirable to make one wise. See, ultimately, in a lot of ways, wisdom and godly wisdom comes down to desire. In fact, if you go back to Proverbs 8, wisdom personified puts it this way: I love those who love me and those who seek me. In other words, those who desire me. Those are the ones who find me. It's not particularly insightful to point this out, ladies and gentlemen, but we typically find in life what we're looking for. We often fail to understand how fully we really are shaped by our desires. Wisdom makes very clear, I'm only found by those who really want me. Reality is, ladies and gentlemen, our hearts are shaped by what we really desire. That's why we see what we want to see so often. Or we find ways to rationalize what we really want to do. And too often what really happens as well, because of our ability to rationalize, is too often we want good things at the wrong time or for the wrong purpose. The reality, ladies and gentlemen, is that desire is not neutral. Desire, what we really want, what we define as desirable for ourselves, what we allow to take root in our hearts is what we desire out of our life and our existence. That desire impacts how we see the world. It impacts how we see others. We either see the world the way God sees it, or disordered desire debilitates our perception of God and His purposes in the world. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, God says, you will die if you eat of it. Satan says, no, you will not die if you eat of it. And what does Eve see now when she looks at the tree? It's desirable, after all, for a wisdom that Satan's tempted her into. She saw what she wanted to see in that tree. Because desire is never neutral. Wisdom's discipline means that we quit allowing even natural desires to have priority in our thinking and in our hearts without wisdom's chastening hand and discipline. Again, listen to wisdom in Proverbs chapter 8. She puts it this way. She says, take my instruction instead of silver, and knowledge rather than choice gold, because wisdom is better than jewels. And all that you may, here's that word again, desire, all that you may desire cannot compare with her. Take me instead of silver and gold. Because I'm telling you, all that you desire can't compare with me. There's something natural, disordered though it may be, about our desire for the material. I mean, we covet, we want, we crave, we pursue. We're fundamentally greedy people. That's why Jesus had to talk so much about money. That's why he had to talk about you can't serve two gods. The name Jesus gave to the rival god for our affection is what? He called it, remember the word? Mammon. The material. Usually a lot of our more modern translations will render mammon as money or something like that. And that's unfortunate because what mammon literally, the root, the idea behind mammon, how mammon came to be their Hebrew and Aramaic word used for money, was mammon was literally that which was tangible and solid, that which you could count on because you could hold it in your hand. It was substantive. And that which was substantive became a good way of thinking about money. Because at the end of the day, how do we put it in our society? Money talks. Money provides. Money protects. We measure things by money. We measure jobs by money. We'll often choose a job we want to take, not over its intrinsic worth or whether we're even going to like it or not. How do we often choose what we're going to do? We choose it based upon which offer has the higher paycheck. Yet wisdom comes back and says, listen, there are some natural desires, disorder they may be, some natural desires, and you're going to have to say no to them. Reorient your desires. Satan, the world, foolishness has offered us a counterfeit wisdom. She looked at that tree, and what she saw, she thought was a source of wisdom. And it destroyed her. And it destroyed Adam. And the plague of sin that she's let loose has destroyed every human being who's reached the age of accountability ever since. When wisdom well disciplines our desires, which is what she wants to do, then we are ready to hunger and thirst for righteousness. When wisdom well disciplines our desire, when we learn to accept wisdom's instructions, when we choose not the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, when we choose the tree of life that God still offers us through Jesus, when we choose wisdom paths and not foolishness, when wisdom well disciplines our desires, then we are ready to hunger and thirst for righteousness, for God's version of reality. What does that look like? Well, think what happens. We begin to have an awareness and understanding that allows us to see something like our time or our talent or our possessions or our opportunities the way God does. My life and all of it that comprises it, the life, the actual time I have in this world, the talents that I may have, the abilities that I may possess, the money that I have, the opportunities that present themselves and the circumstances of my life. They're not for my own personal advantage. My life is to help and serve, to empower others in their relationship with God. That's why the book of Proverbs often comes back and points out that basically the wise man is not just righteous, but the wise man is the person who attunes his ear to the poor, the needy, the oppressed, the struggling. The wise is also committed to justice and fairness. Because the truly wise understands then that my life is not for myself. And so a principle we're so well familiar with from, if nothing else, Jesus' own example, becomes part and parcel of what true wise living really is. Well, how do we shape desire? And wisdom wants to do that for us, but how do we ultimately shape desire? Let me suggest to you honestly that one of the best ways to shape desire is through worship. Is through worship. Deuteronomy chapter 30, beginning of verse 15. Moses gets to the end of his days. This is his final sermon. As I was telling the high school class this morning, I'll tell you what, if you think my sermons can be long, it's not 34 chapters long. That's what Moses gave them that last day. It's a long book. Gets to the end of it, Deuteronomy chapter 30, his final sermon, his final desperate appeal to people whom he loves, but people whom he also knows all too well. Knows their propensity for self, sin, and foolishness. And so he gets to the end in Deuteronomy chapter 30, and he puts it this way, beginning of verse 15. He says, see, I've set before you today life and good, death and evil. That sounds kind of wisdom literature-ish, doesn't it? Two paths, two trees, two options, two ways. Moses says, you get the end of the deal here. I've given you the law. I've reminded you of the law. I've told you about God's plan for you and the land and how you can stay in the land. At the end of the day, Moses says, look, it's real simple. I've put before you two choices, two ways, life and death, good and evil. If you obey the commandments of the Lord your God that I command you today by loving the Lord your God, by walking in his ways, by keeping his commandments and his statutes, his rules, then you shall live and multiply and the Lord your God will bless you in the land that you are entering to take possession of it. In other words, if you live by wisdom, because at the end of the day, wisdom and God's law are pretty much synonymous in a lot of ways. But, he says, if your heart turns away and you will not hear, and you are drawn, and what's interesting, he doesn't list sins. He doesn't list, you know, sexual immorality or greed and injustice. He doesn't put it that way. He doesn't contrast walking by God's ways with breaking God's ways as such. He contrasts not listening to God with not breaking specific commands, but worshiping other gods and serving them. Isn't that interesting? An interesting way to get at it. Don't commit sexual immorality, people commit sexual immorality. Don't be greedy and unjust, people who are greedy and unjust. Don't covet, people who covet. On the positive side of the ledger, it's keep God's commands. On the other side of the ledger, it's not breaking God's commands as such. It's worshiping other gods. Come back to that in just a second. But he puts it this way then in verse 18. I declare to you today, you do that, you'll surely perish. You shall not live long in the land that you're going over the Jordan to enter and possess. I call heaven and earth a witness against you today that I have set before you life and death, blessing and curse. Therefore, choose life, that you and your offspring may live, loving the Lord your God, obeying his voice, holding fast to him, because he is your life and your length of days, that you may dwell in the land that the Lord swore to your fathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. See, here's the thing. In the midst of these ways of getting at this, two ways, two paths, two options, two trees, you have this impassioned plea. Moses begs them, choose life. But when he comes to the alternative, it's obey God, or it's literally worship other gods. Because what Deuteronomy well understands, ladies and gentlemen, at a deep, if not explicitly expressed level, is that what we worship and what we desire are intimately, inextricably related. We ultimately worship what we desire. That's what Jesus was getting at in shorthand when he said you can't serve two gods, you can't serve God and mammon. We ultimately worship what we desire. Nobody in this day and age would literally sit there and say, I worship my money, but what do people do all the time practically by the choices they make and the way they live? They are, in fact, worshiping money. We worship what we desire, whether we realize it or not. And that's why, on the one hand, the contrast in Deuteronomy when it comes to choosing life, two ways before you. Choose life. The opposite of obeying God is not disobeying God. The opposite of obeying God is worshiping another god. Because anytime we reject God's wisdom, anytime we fail to obey God's commands, what we have fundamentally done is chosen another god. You obey God, or in fact, you worship something else, whatever it may be. For a lot of people, if it's not money, it's themselves. We are not yet wise, as one writer put it. But we continue to worship so that through Scripture we may study what God desires for this good but broken creation. And in prayer we may grow and change until we burn with like desire to God's own. See, ultimately, what worship is, sometimes people sit there and say sometimes, you know, well, I'm not going to go to worship today. I don't feel like worshiping today because my heart's not in it. Sometimes that's the time we need to go and worship more than others, because ultimately we put our will over how we feel, our emotions, our experiences, and we choose what we worship. We choose what we were going to say and what we're going to confess. Listen, everybody gets to a point in their life when they are spiritually low and they don't feel like worshiping. Those are days when it's all the more important to come, not because you're a hypocrite or because you're faking it, because it's all the more important you put your will over your mind and you choose to point your desire not in yourself or how you feel or in your circumstance, but you point your desire all the more back to God. And then coming to God and confessing His name and reading His Word, listening to His Word and praying to Him, which is as much about shaping our will to God's as shaping His to ours. Praying to Him, singing about Him, good words from good songs, partaking of the supper. What are we doing? We're forcing ourselves to go back behind God once again, and we're forcing ourselves to see His reality, to confess it and acknowledge it. And I don't know about you, but there have been times, and I can say this, it's dangerous for me to say this as a preacher, but I will. There are sometimes with some days when it's hard for me to do this, but you know what? I always feel better afterwards, and I'm glad I was here and I did it, because I came and I forced my desire back to where it needs to be, because that's what worship does. Because at the end of the day, ladies and gentlemen, we worship what we desire. Moses understood that. The wisdom literature understood that. Jesus understood that. And Jesus ultimately, to bring it to a close, puts it this way. He says, enter by the narrow gate. There's always two ways. Jesus' spin on this old, ancient, revealed truth. There's a narrow gate. There's a wide gate, too. And that way, Jesus says, because He's honest about it, that way is, what's the word? Easy. That leads to destruction. That's why there are those who enter it who are many. But the gate is narrow, and the way that leads to life is hard. And those who find it are few. Two gates, Jesus says. And He says, listen, I'll be honest about these two paths, these two gates, these two ways. One's harder than the other. The way to life is hard. God never said it wasn't. Wisdom disciplines. That's her job. That's her role. Our desires are disordered. Let's be honest. Sin is pleasurable. But ultimately, throughout the ages, those who are wise in the fear of the Lord, understand, as wisdom put it one last time in Proverbs 9 and verse 6, leave your simple ways, your easy ways, your naive ways, your disordered ways, and live and walk in the way of insight. The way that may be harder, but the way that's true. The way that really understands. The way that understands reality, the way God defined it, the creation as God made it, and wants to live in light with that reality, that truth. Satan offers you a counterfeit, to be sure. He tells you the way to death won't actually lead to death. Tells you that there's a wisdom in going with the flow and doing what everybody's doing. But I'll tell you, maybe you're here this morning, you've lived enough of life and you've walked enough of that way, you know that's not true anymore. You know something's missing in your life. You know that sin has cost you dearly. You're paying maybe the price for your foolishness this morning. You're ready to make a U-turn and walk a different path. The good news is the crossroads of decision is always before you as long as you are alive. You can always choose a different path at any moment as long as there's breath in the body. And if you need to make a different decision this morning, we want to help you with it. If you're here this morning, you're ready to make a decision to walk the narrow path. Oh, there'll be challenges, but it's worth it. It's the path of the wise. It's the path of the righteous. And you want to walk that path this morning, we'll help you with that. If you're ready to confess Jesus as Lord and Savior, Son of God, repenting of your sins, that's where you repudiate the way of foolishness. You're tired of living the natural and easy way. Making that decision, making that commitment in your mind and your heart this morning, we'll baptize you for forgiveness of your sins. Here this morning, you're a child of God already, but you have, again, made the wrong decision. The crossroads before us day by day, and you've picked the wrong path. You've left the narrow, challenging path you started upon. And the good news is the on-ramp is always open as long as you're alive. Pray to God for forgiveness, however you've missed the way and left the path. We'll pray with you for you, help you, hold you accountable, talk with you. Do whatever we can for you if you'll come and talk with us right now while we stand, while we sing.